For the past few years, one of my uncles and one of my aunts have been feuding. So by now, no one is clear what the whole thing is about and how it started, possibly because of something somebody said to the other person at dinner a few years ago. But as you can imagine, their kids and everyone else have been dragged into this thing. Like at my mom's birthday dinner every year, either one of them would say, "I'm not coming," if they're coming, or if they both come, you have to find like the furthest point in the room to sit them. So I'm sure you have your own version of this story. Happens all the time, right? People disagree, they fight, they hold grudges, even in church. And this is what I think Paul is actually writing about in Philippians. Philippians is a very strange letter for Paul compared to his other ones. There are only two letters of his in the Bible where he writes not as an apostle, and this is one of them. The first three chapters are a bit confusing. He's almost rambling, not clear why he bought paper and postage for this. This is because all the other Paul's letters, he's always correcting theological error with his most serious tone of voice. And he gets to it right from the beginning, like at the prayer at the beginning. And here, he's just kind of talking around something. So when I was growing up, I had a friend in youth group who also liked to draw. And we drove our sisters crazy when we played Pictionary together, because he and I are more interested in shading our drawings properly than to actually sketch out the clue. So at some point early in the game, one of our sisters would just lose it, and they would scream, "Oh, just get on with it." So the first three chapters of Philippians feels a lot like a lot of shading, until we get to chapter 4, when he finally says, "I plead with Euodia, and I plead with Syntyche, please, try and get along." Apparently Paul got wind that there were these two women squabbling. Probably not theological disagreement, because Paul would just nail that. But just some sort of differences in opinion, so trivial to Paul that he doesn't even tell us what it is. But once we realize this and go back and read the whole letter, we realize what he's been going on about. He's painting us a portrait of good friendship, where Jesus is the exemplar of the deepest kind of love, and why we, as his friends, might consider duplicating that deep love for each other. So, do you find it easy to get along with people? When I interviewed to become a church planter, one of the things I had to do was to take a whole bunch of personality tests and then sit and go through them with the psychologist. It was very intimidating. So on the day when he sort of presented the results of the test to the group of us, he said, "There's this one test where most people score 2 out of the 4 characteristics. Scoring all 4 means somebody did it wrong and the test is void. And only 0.1% of the population scores a combination of 3. And then he said with some excitement, like he just saw a unicorn, he said, "We have one of these 0.1% in the group." And then he turned and pointed at me. Now, I still haven't figured out if it's good news or bad news, but in that moment, I get it. That result explains so much of the challenges I have in my friendships all my life, trying to make friends and keep friends. And the test result makes it official. I am really, really odd. As Kermit the Frog says, it's not easy being green. Philippians, it's a letter. And the Romans take the letter writing very seriously. There are different formats for different situations and different sort of interaction. And Philippians takes the form of a friendship letter, the kind between equals, which has a different tone and a different format than if it's a dad writing to a son, or a pastor writing to a congregation, or a boss writing to an employee. And it's a fascinating choice for Paul, because he's choosing to write as a peer to the people he's talking to, and he cannot preach, he cannot teach. So instead of commanding the ladies to get along, he ties his own hands and has to find another way to nudge them to make up with each other. And maybe he does this because he knows you cannot legislate love. Well, you can try. But then you just get something that looks like love, but it doesn't feel like love. Real love, true love, has to be voluntary, without coercion or obligation. It's a completely free decision, be choosing to love instead of something else. So that's why Paul is shading. He has left all the bossy words in his pencil case and has to find a way to make his point gently. So as the picture emerges from the shading, we see what appears to be a minor squabble between the two ladies. In fact, it's tethered to something much bigger at stake. The two ladies may not think it matters to anybody. They're not on speaking terms or however they're acting out the fight. To Paul, there's a huge mountain underneath that molehill. Paul tells us the world judges Jesus by the quality of our friendships. Whether the gospel is really good news for the world hinges on our ability to get along. Especially if we manage to get along, if in the world we are the sort of people who don't usually mingle. Jesus showed us a way to love people that can create the most unlikely friendships if we're willing to replicate the way he loves. Roman society is built on the values of Greek philosophers, and Greek philosophers really, really value good friendship. What is a friend? Aristotle says, it's one soul dwelling in two bodies. Maybe because love is purely voluntary, we get to choose our friends. When we love our parents or our children, there's an element that we ought to if we're decent people who take pride in doing the right things. But in friendship, there's no inherent obligation. Nothing dictates that I should love you if you're not my family, or if I don't work for you, or if you're not my emperor. Our friends are people we choose to love just because we want to, not because we have to. Now, the Greek word that describes the most intimate kind of Roman friendship is koinonia. It's more intimate than all other kinds of relationships. It's the favorite word used to describe marriage. And it's often translated in the English Bible as fellowship, which unfortunately just reminds me of things I did at church on Friday night. As much as those are good times, this doesn't even come close to what koinonia describes. Koinonia is more like camaraderie, something like the bond between two soldiers in the trenches together, being in it together for something, utterly trusting the other person has their backs. It's Achilles and Patroclus in Greek myth. It's Jonathan and David in the Old Testament, and it's Bert and Ernie on Sesame Street. When Bert sings, Bert, you're a real friend. I'm messy, and you don't like it messy. But because I'm your friend, you don't mind too much I'm messy. Not minding. That's what friends are for. This is how Paul starts his letter, saying they're comrades in the gospel in 1:5. In the trenches, living out the gospel, which makes our friendship uniquely different than all of our other social friendships. The mountain hitched to the bottom of the molehills of our differences is no less than the life pulse of the kingdom. And just like soldiers in the trenches have to park the petty differences to work together as bullets are flying over their heads, living out the gospel also requires us to set our differences aside as a matter of priority. Imagine the two women listening to this as the letter is read out loud in church and everyone is sitting there listening. At what point did they figure out Paul is talking about them? Of course, it sounds warm and fuzzy on paper. But as much as we need good friendship, as much as it is a virtue in Greek philosophy, is it even doable when we're so different, like 0.1% kind of different? We have our opinions, we have our own sets of likes and dislikes, and what we don't mind putting up with and what are absolute deal breakers. It's Ernie Burke kind of friendship possible between the two guys who are working the Muppets? Paul says yes, because Jesus did it, and Jesus shows us how. John says in his gospel, 15:13, greater love has no man than this, to lay down one's life for one's friends. Jesus holds the patent on koinonia friendship. The audacious thing about New Testament writings is the way they describe our relationship with the triune God as the koinonia. This is quite unthinkable in the Roman world, because in the Greek ideas of koinonia friendships, deep intimacy requires two people to behave as equals. And as much as Romans love the idea of close friendship, they also value hierarchy and class differences in society. So trying to be friends with people who have more or less status than we do is sort of awkward, kind of like in Korea, where they also prize hierarchy and class distinction. And it's just not proper to socialize with your boss or your subordinates, and it's just completely frowned upon. There's this YouTube video on the YouTube that teaches people how to insult people in Japanese. So it's this language teacher, and what he did was he did some research, and he notices that English-speaking people insult people by calling each other idiots or some similar word. So he starts by making a list of Japanese words for idiots, and then kind of goes through them. And then he says, but you know, actually, it's not very insulting to call someone an idiot in Japanese culture. If you really want to insult someone, he says, you speak to a superior without the appropriate formal language. So the most insulting thing you can say to your boss is to talk to them like they're your buddy, or worse, the guy at 7-Eleven. Of course, this only works in places where people really care about maintaining social hierarchy, like ancient Rome. And this is the thing that makes friendship almost impossible between an equal person. Have you heard there's a new emperor in Japan? He has a daughter, Princess Mako. 2 years ago, she introduced the world to this guy that she'd been dating. It's a guy who works as a paralegal, and he has hair like Shaggy on Scooby-Doo. So the public went nuts because, as you can imagine, there are plenty of people who think that this guy is not good enough for the princess. And that's probably why recently he enrolled in law school. He's trying to improve his social standing. But the truth is, the princess is not allowed to marry the commoner. So if they do end up getting married, she would have to give up her title and standing as princess and leave the imperial family. So apparently she thinks he is worth it. This is not generally how our North American society works. We value equality. So I hope these Japanese and Korean stories help to illustrate what in the Roman mind, it is a wild thing to describe our relationship with God as a koinonia, when there is this unbridgeable distance between us. We and God are unequal in every way possible. And it's not just Romans. In the Old Testament, the human relationship with God is a covenant, which is typically the kind of relationship between a king and a lower status person. It's a relationship of unequal power. In Greek stories, Greeks hate humans. They literally cannot stand our smell, and they make it a point to sneer if we get too close. So before Jesus, the predominant view in the world is that humans are not worthy of being friends with God. And any God who would consider being friends with us should try to grow better taste than friends. So how do we end up being God's friend? Paul diagrams this in chapter 2. I call this a humility ladder. This is a centerpiece of poetry in the letter. It's like a fountain in the middle of a piazza. Paul describes Jesus in heaven getting up out of his throne. He takes a step down from that high position, and then another step down to becoming a mortal human, and then another step down to becoming a servant, and then drops to the lowest rung by dying like a criminal. This is Jesus lowering himself down to our level without any second thought, in order to arrive at the same level as an equal so we can be friends. Jesus humbled himself, crosses that unbridgeable gap to get into the gutter with us. So apparently with the new covenant, one aspect of relationship with God is a relationship of equals. The one we call Lord is also a brother. It's a koinonia. It's mind-blowing. This is the gospel according to Philippians. Jesus lowered himself in every way until the friendship of equal with us becomes possible. And Jesus did what Princess Mackle is about to do for the dude she loves, bad haircut and all. So then Paul says, if this is what Jesus did to make koinonia possible with us, what are we prepared to do to return the favor? Because another thing about koinonia friendship is that friends have to reciprocate equally so that there are no outstanding debts between them. Again, this is very different than our ideas of friendship, where we think love is doing favors for a friend without needing payback. To the Romans, not reciprocating a favor creates inequality. Because if one of the friends is always paying for dinner and doing favors and the other one's freeloads, then the relationship becomes one-sided. And one-sided friendships cannot be koinonia. Being indebted to one another creates imbalance and obligation, so I can never be sure if my friend is nice to me because he loves me or because he owes me money. Now, of course, realistically, we can never repay fully what Jesus sacrificed for us. Like if a friend gives me a kidney, I can't imagine how I could ever repay them fully for that. But that doesn't mean I don't try, right? If you give me your kidney, I promise you, I would never make you chip in for a meal when we eat together. And you would never hear me say to you, hey, about the $3 you owe me. Because that would just be wrong. If Princess Mako gives up her royalty to marry that guy, the lawyer, she should never ever have to hear about how she's loading the dishwasher wrong, or how did that scratch get on the car, or how the miso soup needs salt. Given that Jesus sacrificed dearly to be friends with me and earned me eternal life, what am I prepared to not mind as I go forward being koinonia friends with Jesus? This is what Paul is getting at in 127 about conducting ourselves in a manner worthy of Christ's gospel. How do we as koinonia friends with Jesus reciprocate his sacrifice, even if what we do is just a little of what Jesus did for us? So as a personal example in chapter 3, Paul takes out a ledger book. It's the balance sheet of his koinonia with Jesus. He draws two columns. On the left is Paul's deposit into the friendship. Here's what Paul has given up for following Jesus. The position he would occupy in Jewish society as someone who was climbing all the right ladders and earning all the right credentials, as someone who was working his way on a spot at the highest council. On the right is what Paul had gained from Jesus. There's just one entry, koinonia. And then he starts crunching the numbers on his calculator. And then he goes, wow, I can't believe I'm in a koinonia with Jesus. I'm making out like a bandit here. So in 1:12 he says, I don't even mind being in chains or being beaten up. I'm just going to add it to the account, and I'm still ahead in the balance sheet. And as a bonus, he says, the pain I endure is advancing the gospel. Fantastic, because Jesus and I both care about that. Because in a koinonia, a friend learns to care about what their friend cares about and are willing to reprioritize the likes and dislikes for the friendship to stay in koinonia. After all, they're in it together. If one wins, both win. And now Paul gets to what he really wants to say, that Jesus' koinonia with us is the model of our koinonia with each other, where we are always prepared to take another step down the humility ladder in order to keep peace with each other so gospel love can come to life at center stage. This is why Paul is writing them a friendship letter. Like Jesus, Paul steps down from his high office as founding pastor, and he drops down next to them on a couch at Starbucks to have a chat. Paul says to them, koinonia is why I make sacrifices between you and me. And he gestures at the walls of his prison cell. In 1:22, he says, my life is a little hard right now. It would be a relief if I die in prison, and then I get to be with my friend Jesus. But on the other hand, our work on earth is not done. You still need me to watch your back in the trenches. Oh, to live or to die, what to do, I can't decide. Now, I don't think Paul actually is depressed. I think he's cracking a joke because the whole letter is kind of cheeky. You know what? He says, I think I will stick around because of you. Laugh aloud. Just kidding. For you, he says, I don't mind going on living. And look at Timothy and Epaphroditus, Paul says in 2:19. They both have willingly suffered hassle for your sake. Timothy worries sick for you. Epaphroditus actually got sick and almost died. But we're all happy to put out for you because we're all your koinonia friends, just trying to love like Jesus. Because a koinonia friend doesn't mind the hassle that comes with doing something hard for the friend, that is good for the friendship. Because if we don't want to be hassled, we should avoid being around people. Chances are, every relationship would eventually need something from us that feels inconvenient. And that's why he says in 1:9, he prays that the love would abound more and more as they work at being koinonia friends, that they would have overflowing love so that their will to stay friends will always be more than the inertia of whatever is driving them apart. Paul isn't making any of this up. I think it's stuff Jesus taught. Like in chapters 14 and 15, Jesus basically says, if you love me, then love one another. And this is the big idea that Paul is sketching out in big screen IMAX, that the way for us to love Jesus back is to pay his love forward with each other in a koinonia friendship. In a world where people are typically selfish and need to win at all costs, this is how God saves the world. Jesus shows us a gospel love that makes koinonia possible beyond philosophy and idealism and romanticism. And we help by letting gospel love come to life among us for all the world to see as a contrast to the way human nature destroys friendship. So if it weren't for the two squabbling women, we wouldn't even know there's actually something like a theology of friendship, where like Jesus and Paul and the Philippians, we're all koinonia friends together in the trenches, contending to live out sticky love so the world can see the difference love makes to everything, simply because we take after Jesus and willingly redraw the line between what we mind and what we're willing to overlook with each other. You remember that familiar story in John 21, when after Jesus' resurrection, we find the disciples where they've been fishing, and Jesus cooks them breakfast. And then he has this conversation with Peter, where three times Jesus asks Peter, do you love me? And then three times Peter says, I love you. And then Jesus asks Peter to take over tending his sheep. Now, if you look up Greek words for love in Wikipedia, you'll find four words. Here are two of them. Agape, or the verb akapao, I love, describes a kind of theoretically perfect love. It's what love ought to be for God and emperor and fellow humans. Agape is formal, is idealistic, is something to aspire to. Philia, or the verb phileo, is the actual experience of love. It's all the things we do and feel in koinonia, all the back and forth that make love feel like love. Philia is warm, is soft, it's comforting, reassuring, like a kiss. So keep this in mind as I try to peel back the English layer in this story. Agapao is the way we ought to love. Phileo is what love actually feels like on our skin. So Jesus asked Simon Peter, do you agapao me? I phileo you, Peter answered the first time. Do you agapao me? Jesus asked the second time. You know I phileo you, Peter says. And then Jesus asks, do you phileo me? Interesting, right? You know that I phileo you, Peter said for the third time. And Jesus says, feed my sheep. So if you like puzzles, I invite you to go and try to solve this one with all the two words flipping. But this is what I think is happening. Jesus asked Peter, do you love me like the way you're supposed to for God and a teacher? And Peter answered, not just that. I love you like a brother. Jesus asked the second time, do you love me the kind of idealistic love people imagine in songs and poetry? And Peter answered, not just like that. I love you with all the actual affection I feel for a brother. And then Jesus asked, do you really love me like a brother? And Peter answered, you know I do, you know I do. And Jesus says, if you love me like a brother, then pay my love forward by loving each other. I believe this is what Paul is teasing out longhand for the two ladies in Philippi. So in 4:6, Paul tells them that through Christ-like humility, they would discover in the koinonia a peace that surpasses understanding. Paul is not talking about life stresses. By peace, he means getting along. And by understanding, he means opinions. Paul is talking about how through Christ-like humility, we can cultivate a unity that transcends our differences. There are two ladies, Esther Kim and Kay Pohl. They've been friends since they were kids learning Taekwondo from one of their dads. So in the year 2000, they found themselves as opponents in the final match fighting for the one spot on the Olympics team, in the U.S. Olympics team. But in the match before, Poe dislocated her left kneecap, and she had to be carried off by her coach, off a flight of stairs back into the training area. But Poe wasn't willing to give up, so she told Kim, I won't quit, we have to fight. I'll just do the best I can. And Kim said, how? You can't even stand. So Kim said, okay, I will forfeit. And Paul refused, but Kim insisted. She said, I won't be losing my dream. I would just be handing it off to you. Now, at that time, sports writer everywhere called this an exceptional act of sportsmanship and selflessness. When sports is wrought with scandals and commercialism and greed, the director of the U.S. Taekwondo Association explained it this way. They have a relationship that transcended sport. That's how they know it's not a win, if winning means kicking a friend when they're down. So, what do we need to transcend in our friendships? Do you think loving like Jesus is enough to transcend it? Our individualism, our personalities, our likes and dislikes, our ambitions and goals? Social media was sold to us as something to help us find things in common with strangers. Instead, it seems to be highlighting all the ways we're different and why we should all just live on our own island. If Jesus was willing to drop to the bottom of the humility ladder to make friends with us when we were enemies, what would be our reason to refuse lowering ourselves just one rung for a friend? Jesus thinks we can do what he did. He gives us his spirit to help us, and he's betting his life and the whole kingdom on us. And this is Paul's invitation to us to build koinonia friendships that transcend our need to be the center of the universe and bring kingdom love to life in a way people can touch and feel, so the world would know Jesus' love by our love, love that is willing to lose out to a friend, so the friendship could win, so the gospel wins. because it's the way Jesus loves us. The love that he asks us to reciprocate and replicate by doing everything we can to live in harmony with each other, a harmony that outsizes our opinions and preferences, even if it means pain and hassle and giving up the right to be right all the time. And this is how we help God save the world, through friendship, one friend at a time. So I'm going to end by casting you to the beginning of the next chapter from the message. If you've gotten anything at all out of following Christ, if his love made any difference in your life, if being in a community of the Spirit means anything to you, if you have a heart, if you care, then do me a favor. Agree with each other. Love each other. Be deep-spirited friends. Don't push your way to the front. Don't sweet-talk your way to the top. Put yourself aside and help others get ahead. Don't be obsessed with getting your own advantage. Forget yourself long enough to lend a helping hand. Think of yourselves the way Jesus Christ thought of himself. Amen.